Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
To the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow night, Tuesday, July 21st, and the following Tuesday, July 28th, PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, will be rerunning a remarkable two-part American Experience documentary titled Clinton, an illuminating examination of the life and career of our 42nd president, William Jefferson Clinton. It's hard to think of another figure from the second half of the 20th century who was so charismatic and so controversial, someone so lavishly gifted and yet also so deeply flawed, somebody who powerfully shaped and influenced his time in both intended and unintended ways. The man responsible for this fine film is Barrett Goodman. He is the writer, director, and producer of Clinton. Barrett Goodman's work on PBS has been seen in other fine films, including Kinsey, Boy in the Bubble, Scottsboro, An American Tragedy, and also a film that is widely regarded as the definitive documentary of the My Lai Massacre in Vietnam. Again, this two-part American Experience documentary, titled simply Clinton, airs tomorrow night and the following Tuesday night on Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And Barrett Goodman, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Thanks, Greg. It's always great to talk to you.
And I love talking to you, and I always love watching your films. Each and every one seems like a labor of love. If I could begin with, I think, a question that may be on the minds of a number of people watching this film. When it comes to as polarizing a figure as William Jefferson Clinton, I wonder where the place of bias is and sort of personal preference when it comes to the filmmaker. I mean, as you came to this project, can you tell us a little bit about your own personal feelings about President Clinton, who he was and what he represented, and to what extent that either informed the making of this film or to what extent you were able to try to lay some of those personal feelings aside?
That's a great question, and it was the very first thing my boss, when he assigned me the film, said to me, is that you've got to check your own political views at the door. But the truth is that this is really a character study more than anything else, and I was, intrigued by Clinton for the reasons that you just mentioned. He is such a divisive figure. He is such a polarizing figure. Why? What is it about him that either inspires such, devotion and love, or the opposite in people? So my own personal views of his politics or contemporary politics took a somewhat lesser role, I think. I was very much more interested in who he was, and so like a lot of people, I had a kind of nostalgic view of Clinton, I suppose, a feeling of those were the good days when the economy was booming and we weren't in wars and so forth. But very quickly, that really melted away, and it was really about trying to understand this very complicated character.
Well, and the way the world viewed him. I mean, why he was adored by some and loathed
exactly.
by others.
Yes.
I have to just to share my own personal experience of watching the film, which I've had the pleasure of doing. that through much of it, I thought to myself, wow, Barrett Goodman does not like Bill Clinton, only because it's a very frank, honest, and you know, somewhat hard-hitting film when it comes to the ways in which, the many ways in which Bill Clinton stumbled in the early part of his presidency. And by the time we got to the end of the film, I thought, oh, Barrett Goodman feels more positively about President Clinton than I initially thought. And as I sort of got done, I realized once again, I think Barrett Goodman has managed to craft actually an incredibly fair, even-handed film, and no small feat when it comes to somebody like Bill Clinton. But I wonder if other people who watch this film are kind of experiencing the same thing that I did.
You know, I am fully prepared for people to see very, very different things in the film. I think people come to this with such a strong sense of the man, either personal like or dislike, that two people are very unlikely to feel the same way about it. And I analogize it to a kaleidoscope. You look at Clinton from slightly different points of view, depending on your own politics, and everything looks different. You know, is he a manipulator? Is he cynical? Was his move to the center, for example, when he revived his presidency 2 years into it, a cynical ploy to win voters, or was it a heartfelt, return to his own political roots? Those two points of view are equally valid in some ways, and it really depends on how you view him. So I'm fully expecting to be criticized from both sides. I don't think Clinton and the Clinton camp will like this film very much because they don't like to be criticized. On the other hand, I'm sure conservatives will find it too soft. So as long as we're sort of pissing off both sides equally, I feel we've done our job. And, as for my own personal feelings, I this is Clinton's story. He rises from the ashes over and over again. He finds himself in places that no other politician could possibly escape from, and yet he does it Houdini-like over and over again. And so I'm not surprised that you experience that roller coaster in watching the film, because that really is Clinton's life and career.
Right. Somebody, I think, towards the end of the film likens him to an argument without end. I remembering
like that
right?
Absolutely. That's John Harris, and that's exactly my feeling. This film will not resolve once and for all, you know, whether Clinton was a great president, a good president, or a bad president. It will only inspire more conversation about it, I think.
I wonder if you could say a word about making the film now. And this is something I enjoy asking various documentarians about various projects. And, of course, the challenges are different if you're talking about looking back at Custer's Last Stand versus somebody like Harry Truman versus President Clinton, who in the scope of history is the day before yesterday.
Right.
Probably it would have made some sense to wait a little longer to gain a little more perspective. And on the other hand, there's this incredible immediacy about making the film now, of course, with a lot of important principal players in his drama still very much with us to be part of this film. Could you just talk about the timing of it?
Yes. This was a subject of a lot of thrashing and thought and conversation at WGBH, where American Experience is located. Is he part of history? Has he receded enough from the scene politically to justify a look backwards? And I think it was, it was on the edge, but the feeling, Mark Sammels, the executive producer, felt that enough dust had settled, and even more importantly, I think, one could trace the roots of our current contemporary political scene so clearly to the Clinton administration that it merited an historical treatment. It merited a look back. And in fact, I think he was vindicated. I mean, the people who populate the film, all the interviews in it, and there were almost 70 that we talked to, they spoke with a candor and a sort of, honesty that I think could only happen if, a lot of the passions had settled a bit, and there was no gloss, there was no trying to spin me. These were very, very honest takes on the years that they'd lived through. And I think that, when that can happen, you know, you can feel comfortable that what you're doing is really looking back honestly at a set of events rather than kind of being in the midst of it and trying to contend with different people spinning things for their own reasons. That didn't seem to happen in this case. So all in all, I think it was the right call, and I feel like the most important thing is that this story so informs what's happening now. If you look at the Obama administration, you superimpose it on top of the Clinton administration, it tracks almost exactly what happened to Bill Clinton. And so we can learn so much about what's going on today by looking back at those 8 years.
Hmm. You have assembled a really impressive group, including people who were part of the Clinton administration, friends, those who worked with him back in Arkansas, and journalists of various stripes, and a couple of hardcore conservatives who very much disliked the man and worked against him. And I'm really astonished at everyone who you were able to assemble. I mean, that being said, of course, there are some people missing it would be fun to hear from, but in no way do we get to the end of this and feel like there are gaping holes. I mean, it's quite impressive. Could you just say a word about the process by which you secure participants for a film like this? I mean, how does one phrase the overture? How is the overture delivered?
Well, the lucky stroke here was that the Clinton Foundation blessed the project, knowing nothing about it other than it was being done by American Experience and PBS. They understood that we were doing it with or without them, but there would be a group of people who would not talk to us without at least some nod of approval from them. And I think that they, you know, to their credit, they decided that the people they most wanted in the film were the people that would seek their approval. So they gave that approval, and that opened the door for a lot of the closest Clinton confidants. But, you know, that even without that, we would have gone forward because there are enough people who feel like it's time to talk. It's time to, you know, there's been so much back and forth about Clinton and so much back and forth about those years. And a lot of people who haven't really been candid in the past, I think, are ready to you know, give their 2 cents. So, and it becomes viral. Once we get a few people, more people want to talk. They don't want to be represented without representing themselves, and it just kind of snowballs. Mm. And you know, the pitch was basically that this is the first comprehensive look at his life and times and career, and it's a character study, and we need to hear from the people who were closest to him to get it right. And I think people appreciated that and stepped forward. So, you know, out of I think 70 interviews, we maybe had 10, fewer than a dozen who said no to us. So we were, you know, obviously very pleased with that.
Sure. How about the matter of journalists? I mean, one journalist that had to be here and is here is Michael Isikoff from Newsweek,
right.
Who ended up being kind of a principal player in the unraveling of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But otherwise, in terms of other journalists, how do you choose? I mean, every journalist on the planet, and certainly every journalist in America, has very strong feelings about President Clinton. How do you end up making difficult choices like that about which journalistic voices to include?
Well, they were difficult. We went for those who covered him the longest and the closest, and we went for those who had written the most thoughtful books, articles, magazine stories, or, you know, television pieces about him. I mean, those people who had really thought through and had a very deep basis of knowledge from which to think and synthesize. So Joe Klein is an example. I mean, Joe Klein's famous for being anonymous and writing Primary Colors, a novelization of Clinton's campaign in 92. But he also wrote a book called The Natural, which is a very interesting, thoughtful, and I think insightful book about Clinton's political prowess. And Joe is extremely funny and interesting guy, and he is one of the most prominent interviews. But there are many such people. John Harris, of current editor of Politico, is another example. I think John Harris wrote the best book about Clinton. It's called The Survivor, which is exactly the right right way to describe Clinton, and he has a very, very interesting and deep knowledge and take on Clinton's life. So, you know, it's those people, and David Marinus, the biographer of Clinton's early years, those are the tentpole interviews in the piece, and they're, you know, surrounded by people who were very close and worked very closely with Clinton.
And I must say, it feels to me like just the right number. It's that we hear from all kinds of different people, all kinds of different voices, and probably many more, and we would have ended up being sort of overwhelmed and not heard enough from particular people, and yet it's great to have this rich diversity of voices weighing in on this very divisive figure.
My favorites are the Arkansas folks. I mean, because I think the whole first hour of the film basically is set in Arkansas, and we hear from people that no one knows, no one's spoken to, and the way that they talk about him, the fondness, the sort of it's all over their faces, the love they have for this man, and the admiration. It's almost sort of a kind of, you know, I can't believe I was there to know this guy. I mean, he was a glorified country bumpkin, really. He came out of nowhere in Arkansas, and they're so proud of him, and were so dazzled by him even at the time, and that just kind of shines in their faces. And I really love talking to, you know, his childhood friends and his campaign manager and his first congressional campaign and those people who were with him for the rise.
Right.
Those were the most interesting interviews in some
sure.
way.
And, of course, when we hear from a couple of them weighing in on how devastating it was for them to see President Clinton, to the lies about Monica Lewinsky exposed, I mean, it is absolutely heartbreaking for them. And on the other end of the spectrum, for instance, we have Special Prosecutor Ken Starr, prominently featured, as well as Lucian Goldberg, the literary agent who really played a very crucial role in bringing the Monica Lewinsky matter to light. I mean, about as far ideologically from those folks in Arkansas as you can possibly get.
I found both of those people so interesting. I mean, Ken Starr is one of the great enigmas of our time. I mean, as much as Clinton is debated, so will Ken Starr be. He's either looked at as a far-right-wing ideologue who was out to get Clinton from the beginning. I came to have a slightly different point of view. I think that Ken Starr was not acting out of political bias, but he was acting out of a kind of prosecutorial zeal that really overtook him. And it was a very interesting experience interviewing him because, of course, I came to that interview full of questions about why he did what he did. And he was, you know, evasive, I guess is a way of putting it, slippery. He fixes you with a smile and will not be shaken from his basic, you know, feeling that he was doing his job. He was acting as any prosecutor would. He was not overstepping his bounds. He did concede at one point that perhaps he was not the best person to have investigated the Monica Lewinsky affair, having started off with Whitewater. But that's about as much as he would concede. It was frustrating in some ways, but very revealing in other ways. So I found him to be intriguing. And the other person you mentioned, Lucian Goldberg, is the lesser known but probably key person in the Monica Lewinsky scandal, in the sense that she really brokered the whole thing. She really was the person who brought it from a private, she and Linda Tripp, her confidant, two of them, brought this from a private matter into a, you know, a public catastrophe. And I don't think many people understand her role in that.
We're speaking with Barrett Goodman. He is the writer, producer, director of a two-part documentary about President Bill Clinton, airing tonight and tomorrow night on the PBS series American Experience. One thing you do that I really appreciated is, for the most part, the film unspools chronologically. But I do love the way in which it begins not at the beginning. It begins with a really crucial moment in the initial Clinton presidential campaign and then flips backward. I was thinking, I actually, as I sort of loaded the disc into my DVD player, I found myself wondering, I wonder where this is going to begin. Is this going to begin? I mean, and one could just choose any number of critical moments. It's fascinating the way you ended up opening the film. Tell our listeners about that and why you felt like this was the way to usher us into the story of Clinton.
The film begins with the New Hampshire primary in 1992, which for me distills Clinton's whole sort of essence into a few weeks. And it's obviously a crucial moment. People remember it's the moment that he kind of broke onto the national stage. You know, he was a sort of unknown figure, a little known figure, and then began to catch fire in New Hampshire as the front runner. And then all of a sudden, the Jennifer Flowers scandal breaks. And what was interesting to me was you had in that moment everything about Clinton, his sexual peccadilloes and that problem that would haunt him his whole life, his relationship with Hillary, which is a key theme, obviously, in this film, and how Hillary stepped forward to, as one person in the film says, save him, which she did repeatedly. She steps forward to kind of, you know, put herself between him and the press and say, look, you know, I'm standing by him. And then you had his incredible capacity to come back from political catastrophe. You know, almost any other figure, any other modern politician would have been destroyed by the Jennifer Flowers affair. People might remember she was a lounge singer who kind of revealed in the middle of this that she'd had a 12-year affair with Clinton, and she had tapes to prove it. And he not only kind of talked his way out of it, but he so threw himself into the New Hampshire primary, meeting everybody he could, shaking everyone's hand, talking to every little coffee klatch and, you know, VFW post, and just meeting everybody until he willed himself, literally, back into that race and ended up, as he put it, becoming the comeback kid by finishing a strong second there. That is Clinton to a T. So we use that that story to sort of introduce the themes of the entire 4 hours and then launch us back to Arkansas and back to the early years with Hillary and their bond and what their marriage was all about and his ambition. So I thought it was a nice place to start.
I agree. And I also like the fact that you didn't jump right from there to Bill Clinton being born in Hope, Arkansas.
Right.
But that you traveled back in sort of an intermittent step to Hillary Clinton. Because as you say flat out, and I think no one would argue, it was as much Hillary as anyone who saved Bill Clinton in that New Hampshire primary. I mean, almost more than Bill Clinton saved himself. I mean, he almost certainly could not have saved himself had Hillary Clinton also not been part of that. That's self-salvation.
And she does it over and over again. She did it in Arkansas when he lost his first governorship and was basically, you know, flat on his back, not knowing what to do. She lifts him up. She becomes his campaign manager. She pushes him back into the public fray, and she literally saves his career. And again, later in the Monica Lewinsky affair, when she, you know, goes on the Today Show and wags her finger at the press and says, you're not covering the real story here, which is a vast right-wing conspiracy. She was enormously important in pulling him back from the depths and the edge of disaster. And, you know, she's as interesting a figure as he is. People will debate her as well. Was she doing that for her own ambition? That cynical people would say, you know, this is a marriage of convenience. She wants the power as much as he does, and she will do anything, you know, to get it. I don't think that's true. I think that they have a very strong bond. They love each other deeply, and she believes in him. And her disillusionment, her sense of betrayal, especially in the Monica Lewinsky affair, was heartbreaking to sort of, you know, research and then to put on screen. It was, you know, she's a very, at least up until the end, she's a very tragic figure to me. And then, of course, she steps forward to run for the Senate and win her Senate seat, and that launches a kind of renaissance for her. And she has had the glorious career that we know since. But at least in the White House, she felt like a very tragic figure to me, someone who, you know, was betrayed more so than I think anybody else by her husband.
Sure. As you tell us about the two of them first meeting and falling in love and ultimately marrying, you sketch a portrait of two people alike in some ways, but strikingly different in many others. And one of the most interesting observations made is that, in a sense, neither of them could believe that the other was in love with them. I mean, yeah. Bill Clinton couldn't believe that someone like Hillary would love him, and Hillary likewise could scarcely believe that someone like Bill could be in love with her. I mean, that's a very, very intriguing sort of romance there.
It's so fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating, their bond. And they were very and are very, very different people. You know, he is really an ordinary Joe with an incredible, incredible mind. I mean, but his heart, his nature, he's a populist. He's a person, he's a people person. He's a man of the people. And it's his great, I think, the secret to his great political strength. And in some ways, he's a more flexible person than she is. He's not as easily thrown. He's more able to handle the ups and downs, the extreme ups and downs that his career went on. She took things much more to heart. She's much more an idealist in some ways. She's less able to handle, you know, the sort of what she feels are personal attacks against them and unfair attacks. And she's more brittle in some ways. But what they share is this deep, deep commitment to public service, which I think is sincere in both of them. And you know, for each of them, each other are their, you know, the only person in the world that they truly believe is smarter than they are. Bill thinks Hillary's smarter than he is, and Hillary thinks Bill's smarter than she is. And that is, for people as intellectual as they are and as brilliant, that is an extremely strong bond to have. They trust each other's judgment more than anybody else. And that, you know, that was incredibly bonding thing throughout their entire marriage.
Well, and somebody says a really great line at one point in the film about how not only do they love each other and somehow continue to love each other through all they've been through, but that they also, I wish I could remember it was just poetry the way it was said, something about how they both love.
They love things in common.
Yeah, hundreds of things that they love in common. So it's not just love of each other, but also a mutual
right.
love of all kinds of different things. And I'd never heard that expressed exactly that way before, and I'm sure that's true of many couples. And it was important for these two, of course.
Well, people scratch their head about how could Hillary stay with Bill. I mean, he's a serial adulterer. There's no question about that. He's admitted to that, in essence. How could she stay with Bill? It's not, to me, that difficult a leap. Once you understand who they are in their hearts, they're people with intense ambition, but it's ambition that's leavened by real commitment to doing good. And if that's your principal focus in life, and you find a partner who is just as committed as you are, and you can do something great together, and as that person in the film says, you love things in common enormously, that's a very strong bond. The sexual part of it, the betrayal, obviously took a toll on their marriage and took a toll on Hillary. There were several times in their marriage when they nearly split up. But they always came back because they always felt they had these things in common, a common ambition, a common set of goals, and a common set of passions. So it's pretty easy for me to see how they remain married to this day.
You also, I think, do a great job of perhaps touching on some of the ways in which Bill Clinton's difficult childhood
yes.
might have contributed to the way he viewed the world and viewed others and interacted with the world. And I mean, at the risk of trying to make pronouncements that are hard to prove, but I think you make a very persuasive case for a couple of very good possibilities, one of them being that because he lost his father when young Bill was only 6 months old, that there was the sense of the fleeting nature of life that perhaps really fueled his ambition.
Yeah, Well, he says this himself. I mean, in a very, very long memoir, which for the most part reads like a death diary that's written down in prose, there are a couple of really sharp insights into himself. And he says two things in his memoir that I think stand up and really have the ring of truth. One of them is that the death of his father gave him a sense of impatience, a sense that he had to live for both, for two people, himself and his father, his dead father. And you see throughout his career that impatience, that burning, that you know, more so than even all politicians have this, but no one has it like Bill Clinton. His drive was just, people just are amazed by it. But the other important thing that he says in his memoir is that, you know, his stepfather was an abuser. His stepfather was an alcoholic who hit his mother and very severely on a couple occasions. In one occasion, a gun had to be drawn to keep him away. But, you know, Bill Clinton learned to hide things. He learned to wall off unpleasant things in his life. None of his friends knew in Arkansas that his home life had turned so dangerous and so violent. He, to the world, looked like this sunny achiever who was just unstoppable, but there was a whole other side to it. And Bill Clinton says in his memoir that I learned to put up a wall and to keep unpleasantness completely hidden. And the problem with that is that I think he came to believe that secret side of his life, he could indulge in it. He could indulge in whatever he wanted behind that wall, including affairs with interns in the White House, and nobody would be able to see, and nobody would ever find out. There could be essentially two lives, a life that was public and a life that was kept private. And, of course, that was a foolish notion for a president of the United States to believe, as we all know by now.
To say the least. Yeah. Two precious little bits of film, I think, are such an interesting illumination of the young Bill Clinton, I mean, as a young adult. One, we've all heard about the way in which he greatly admired and was inspired by John F. Kennedy. Mm. And so to actually see a few blurry film frames of Bill Clinton actually meeting John F. Kennedy. I mean, he's in a big crowd, but you tell us he kind of pushes his way to the front to be sure to shake hands with the current President Kennedy. I mean, it's electrifying to see that image. And another thing that I so appreciate being included in the film is a very early television commercial from the first time Bill Clinton runs for office back in Arkansas.
Yeah. Some of my favorite stories, again, are the stories from those from that campaign, this congressional campaign. He basically graduated from Yale Law School, went right back to Arkansas, and immediately set up campaign headquarters to run for Congress. And no one could believe that this 25, 26-year-old guy was actually going to try to unseat this longtime incumbent. Nobody believed he had a chance. And the stories that are told about his, you know, incredible, you know, indefatigability. Just, you know, he would sleep on friends' couches, wake, you know, 3 hours of sleep, he'd wake up to go catch the shift change at the factory, and he would drive all day and all night, and the people were, the unfortunates who had to go with him were just dead on their feet. They could not stay with him, and he would insist on, you know, shaking every hand. He'd jump out of cars to go talk to anybody he saw. They were just, you know, people were just dropping like flies around him, and he just wouldn't stop. And I just love, and we have this great campaign commercial, which kind of shows that, and shows that that sort of, you know, young man, young, almost boyish-looking guy, just kind of driving all over Arkansas to get votes. It's wonderful. He didn't end up winning that race, but he did so well that his career was launched, and he was governor within 4 years.
You also tell us that when Hillary left a very well-paying job, a well-connected job in Washington, D.C., to come back to Arkansas to help him, that she was not exactly welcomed with open arms. And in a sense, that really helps us understand that sort of cultural divide or disconnect between a place like Arkansas and a place like Washington, D.C., that was almost regarded like another planet. And in a sense, when Clinton finally becomes president, in a sense, that divide is still there and is the source of some of his most vexing difficulty.
Indeed, and one has to remember that this is the Hillary. There were two Hillarys. The Hillary we see today and saw in the White House, the well-coiffed and beautiful and shining Hillary, but the Hillary that came to Arkansas for that race was something else altogether. She wore big Coke bottle glasses and had disheveled hair and was a sort of intellectual feminist from the East and was completely alien to the people in Arkansas. They'd never seen a woman without any makeup and talk as assertively as she did and push her way around. And she was completely a fish out of water. And it was made worse by the fact that Bill was cheating on her. Although they were not married yet, they were serious and obviously heading for marriage. And yet he was still, womanizing right and left. And so she was miserable, but she stuck it out and learned, and this is Hillary to a T, she learned to adapt, she changed herself, she took his last name, she changed her hair, she got contact lenses, and by the time he was governor in the second term, she was probably more popular than he was in Arkansas. And one person jumped up at a hearing and said, oh my gosh, we've elected the wrong Clinton. Her ability to morph herself, her protean ability to become someone else was, just as remarkable as his was.
Mm. I did not know, I'm not sure I ever knew this, or certainly if I had, I'd forgotten, that he was really thinking seriously about a run for the presidency back in 1987 during his fourth term as Arkansas governor, and actually called a news conference to announce that, and then at the last minute pulled back. Really at the insistence, we're told, of his aide, Betsy Wright, who was interviewed for the film, the issue was womanizing. But it is so interesting to think about how all of this might have played out very differently if, in fact, he had gone forward with that presidential bid 4 years earlier. And you even have a few moments from that very strange news conference where, in effect, he sent the media home with just this enigmatic announcement of needing to spend time with his family. A very curious moment in this career.
It is indeed, and we're privileged to get Betsy Wright, who's given very few interviews. I think she is maybe second to Hillary in the sense that of someone almost broken by the betrayal she felt from Bill Clinton. She was not only his campaign manager for years, but his closest aide, his closest confidant, aside from Hillary, and believed in him utterly. And yet she was also the person who had to clean up his messes. She was the one who had to try to, quiet the bimbo eruptions, as they were called back then. The various women who would come out of the woodwork, she would have to go make sure that they didn't, cause a ruckus. And when he decided to run in 1988, she took him aside and she went down a list of women and said, look, you don't know that these women won't talk. The national press is not like the Arkansas press. They will find these people. They will get them to talk. You have a new daughter, Chelsea. Are you going to be able to handle this? I don't think so. And he was persuaded by her logic and decided to wait, to withdraw. And that actually, there was a moment after that when, the dream seemed dead, the dream seemed gone, and Hillary and Bill seemed all of a sudden not to have a future, in politics. And there was a moment where they almost split at that moment, because what did they have left? That mutual goal was seemed vanished, and all they had was the betrayal and the sourness of that. But I think it speaks volumes about them that they decided to stay together, recommit themselves to the presidency, and 4 years later, he ran.
Mm. Of course, one of the abiding themes of your film, because it's one of the abiding themes of William Jefferson Clinton's life, is his incredible ability to recover from setbacks, from that defeat, the first time he ran for re-election as Arkansas governor, and to recover so miraculously from his disastrous misstep at the Democratic convention, at which he gave a speech supporting Michael Dukakis, in which what could have been a one of his finest hours turned him into a national laughingstock. For anyone who admires Bill Clinton, surely this has to be one of the most painful moments of your documentary, yeah, where you show us some excerpts from that speech, which never ended, enough to give us a taste of just what a humiliating moment this turned out to be. And then, of course, the amazing way in which he managed to spin gold out of that.
He goes on Johnny Carson at the insistence of Harry Thomason, or the suggestion of Harry Thomason, his good friend and a Hollywood producer. He goes on Johnny Carson and handles it so deftly and so magically, so with so much humor and grace and self-deprecating humor, which, of course, Clinton was brilliant at, that in that space of one evening, he turns the whole thing around, and he's more popular than before the speech. So that's Clinton. I mean, he did have this. It was almost like he, as Joe Klein says in the film, almost like he needed to be up against it, to have these enormous setbacks, to really focus him and get him going and refocus him. And it happens over and over again. Of course, the biggest moment of resurrection is after the disastrous midterm elections in 1994. People forget about Clinton, that his first 2 years in office were about the worst 2 years of any president since, you know, maybe Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he was so deeply unpopular that there was nobody thought he could have a chance of being reelected. And in fact, he lost the Congress, and Newt Gingrich really took over Washington. Well, how did Clinton come back from that? That is really such an interesting political story, and shows what tenacity he had under fire. Not only did he manage to get reelected, but he was reelected easily, and he completely mastered the Republicans and you know, kind of overcame their challenge. And watching that happen is really just an incredible case study in political skill.
Of course, your film talks us through the Clinton presidency, beginning with that first election, which, unlike the second, felt like a landslide, but was not a landslide. Clinton
right.
won 43% of the vote. And somebody in talking about those first years in the White House says that basically Clinton nor most of his inner circle had any understanding of sort of the rules of the road in Washington, ill-prepared in so many different ways. And you show us a really telling little bit of footage of Clinton getting ready for one of his very first, maybe his first televised address, and absolutely looks like a deer in the headlights. And it's a kind of an apt metaphor for what those first couple years were like.
Well, for someone who had been preparing to be in the White House since he was 15 years old and shook John F. Kennedy's hand, he was completely unprepared when he got there. I think he totally misunderstood what Washington was about, what running a government was about. I mean, he'd run Arkansas just by sheer dint of his personality. But you can't do that in Washington. As David Gergen says in the film, you know, the people have their knives out. People are wanting you to fail. People are trying to find vulnerabilities. And, you know, you have to create almost a fortress in the White House. And he had the opposite. He was open. He wanted everyone's opinion. He wanted all these young campaign workers from the campaign to come into the White House to run things. And they were completely ill-equipped to do so. He ignored the old lions of Washington, the powers in the Congress. He just thought it was just like Arkansas writ large. And he just made stumble after stumble, and we kind of go through that history. Of course, you know, it wasn't all his fault. There were people who were really trying to undermine him. And, you know, with phony scandals and with kind of, you know, anything they could find to throw dirt on him. And it nearly succeeded. I mean, by the end of those first 2 years, it looked like he was doomed, and there would be no way back from the wilderness he'd gotten himself into.
And, of course, a certain man by the name of Morris steps in and of course, does help turn things around in the wake of the missteps like the healthcare reform effort, the first emergence of the Whitewater scandal, the suicide of Vince Foster. I mean, it's one misstep after another, one misfortune after another. In
right.
some respects, you tell us that one of the things that helped make President Clinton look presidential to the nation in a way that he had not at all up until that point was
right.
the bombing in Oklahoma City.
Right.
In a sense, it gave him an opportunity to display his best gifts.
Exactly. The American people, despite having elected him on this kind of surge of hopefulness, and as you pointed out, it was only 43% of the popular vote because of Ross Perot's presence. There was still a deep, if not mistrust, at least uncertainty about Clinton. He had never displayed the sort of presidential side of him, the side that Ronald Reagan so often showed the country. And then this terrible thing happened in Oklahoma City, which up until that point was the largest terrorist attack on American soil. Hundreds died. And Clinton was able to show that incredible connection he could make to ordinary human beings, that he could get up in front of an audience. He was always best unscripted. He was always best without a teleprompter or notes in front of him or speech to give, when he could just almost, as if he was talking to each person through their television set. He could connect that way, and that was the moment that he really showed himself as a leader. And I think it became very important to have that connection because, as you pointed out, healthcare was still to come and budget debacles and one thing after another. But the American people always liked him. They always found a reason to believe in him, even underneath all the sort of chaos of his administration. I think that is really what brought him through.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the emergence of this incredibly fascinating figure of Dick Morris, who I think is, again, someone that people don't know, whose role they're not fully aware of, how important this guy was in resurrecting Clinton's career.
It's extraordinary. And, of course, we'll have to leave to our listeners pretty much to experience the whole story of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which nearly brought him down. One of the most interesting observations about all of that is from one of his cabinet members, Robert Reich, observing that perhaps the reason Bill Clinton could have committed such a terrible blunder, a nearly fatal blunder, was because it is such a lonely kind of responsibility to be president, and he could not resist this young woman who adored him so much. I mean, it's one of the only times anyone has at least helped me understand how such a misstep could have been possible.
Bill Clinton was a man and a politician who literally needed human contact. He needed to touch people. He needed to have those kinds of connections. It was to take a man like that and put him into this artificial fishbowl of the White House where that was always impossible. He couldn't go out and press the flesh and be with the people. He had to live in this hermetic environment. He tells Dick Morris at one point, he confides in him, that he had to shut his body down. I think that literally was true for him. He just wasn't a person who could adapt very easily to that kind of world. I think Obama finds it more easier to do that. And I mean, that's as close as I can come to an explanation for how such a brilliant man could do something so dumb as start an affair with an intern in the White House, in the Oval Office. I think it was just a need that he had and couldn't be satisfied any other way. And again, he had this belief in him that he could keep these things secret from the world, that there was this private area which was even from Hillary was going to be kept safe, and that was obviously a tremendous mistake.
Mm. Barry Goodman is the writer, director, and producer for Clinton, a two-part American Experience documentary. Part one will air tomorrow night, Tuesday, July 21st. The second part will air the following Tuesday, July 28th. I'm Gregory Berg. And tomorrow on the morning show, Joel Seidelman and his fascinating book, In the Interest of Justice, Great Opening and Closing Arguments of the Last 100 Years. A memorable conversation which I had with Joel Seidelman back in 2005, which we will replay tomorrow.